good night or a good evening, guys. Does anybody need a copy of the questions? All right. So appreciate Cole for reading. Last week we talked about young Samuel approaching old Eli with condemnation, and now in this chapter we get to see the consequences of Eli and his sons. So should be pretty entertaining. I'm going to need some help. Who has the first question? Who?
I had the last one.
Okay, so I guess that would mean Grant. Okay. All right. So our first question for this evening is, are there any textual variants in verse 1 that are worth mentioning? Who was instigating the battle, and why was Israel defeated?
All right. I'm glad that the first question was actually asked, because sometimes I'll forget to look at the very bottom of the Bible where there are the variants listed. I thought it was actually quite helpful, because it does kind of give a little bit of an insight for the question, too. But I'll read what it says here. Following the Masoretic text in Targum, Septuagint, that's the first part, that's what's actually in the, what we have here. But then the Septuagint Vulgate add, and it came to pass in those days that the Philistines gathered themselves together to fight. Septuagint adds further against Israel. So yes, there is a textual variant that does seem to actually have some, quite an effect here on how we interpret the verses. Part B there, who was instigating battle? Well, it depends, I guess, which variant you're going with. According to what it says here, the Philistines gathered themselves together against Israel. Although it doesn't really, without that, kind of, if we take that out and just read as verse 4, as we read earlier, now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines. It doesn't really say whether one was against the other, but it kind of sort of implies that Israel was going out against the Philistines, but the variant there does clear that the Philistines had gathered up against Israel. So it looks like Israel was instigating the battle. So why was Israel defeated? Now, this is kind of a tricky question, because it doesn't really say exactly why they were defeated. So there's some implications. I'm going to make some guesses in a minute. But we do see here that the Philistines went out in battle array. So they were geared for battle, whereas Israel maybe was not. So that may have had some effect as far as why Israel fled before the Philistines. But we do see later on with those other things that happen in this chapter that they don't really consult God at all. They don't seem to go to God and say, should we go out to the battle, or what should we do in this battle? And we see quite the contrary when they take the ark of God and go out to battle, assuming that God is with them, and they rely upon the ark as being to win the battle for them. So why was they defeated? Why were the Israel defeated? Probably because they didn't consult God. I think it's probably the best answer.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you. I agree on who instigated the battle. I know I was talking to Austin and Dad about this, but I tend to think both sides. I don't think you can tell if a certain party instigated it, because they both hate each other. The Philistines hate the Israelites because Shamgar and Samson roughed them up recently. And Israel hates them because they're pagans and they're also in their territory. So, why was Israel defeated? I had Psalm 78. Talks about this. It's a pretty good passage. Psalm 78 verses 56 or 61. I won't read all of them, but basically the highlight of these verses is that Israel provoked him to anger with their high places, and they moved him to jealousy with their carved images. When God heard this, he was furious, and he greatly abhorred Israel, so that he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh and the tent he placed among men. Also, quickly here, Samuel kind of tells us why they lost, because he talks to them in chapter 7, which is like his big first appearance. He says, if you return to the Lord with all your hearts, put away the foreign gods, and prepare your hearts to the Lord and serve him, then he will deliver you. So he kind of, by stating that, kind of tells us what was going wrong a little bit there. Does your brother have any comments? I had a map. Oh, wait. There we go. So this is where the Israelites were encamping, Ebenezer, and then the Philistines were up here. And so the first battle, these are where the two forces are. But then once the Israelites lose, they go all the way back to Shiloh, they get the ark, and they come back, but we're not there yet. But that's kind of what we're looking at there. Go.
Yeah, I kind of thought about the
prophetic nature in the previous chapter, starting in verse 11, where it says, "Then the Lord said to Samuel, Behold, I will do something in Israel, which both the ears of everyone who hears of it will tingle, and that day I will perform against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile and did not restrain them." It's kind of getting into what we'll talk a little bit more in later questions, but obviously as a part of this battle, I think part of the reason that they suffered the defeat was who was in their company, essentially God to bring that judgment. Yes.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't think, I don't get to the nitty gritty here, but they were literally committing fornication near the tabernacle. And if they're going into battle, God's not just going to ignore all of that and let them become champions. Dad?
As far as who initiated the battle, obviously, as you said, we don't know for sure. But notice that the Philistines have come way up into Israelite territory. Aphek is Asher. It was given to the tribe of Asher. And so it is Israelite territory. Now, whether or not the tribe of Asher wanted it, who knows? But I don't see the Israelites as being provocateurs here, because that's just not typically their role. Typically, they want to get along with the nations around them unless God commands them to go to war. And they assimilate. These people like the nations around them. They like their gods, they like their religion. And so it seems to me that 50, 70 years have passed since Samson's battle against the Philistines, where he wounded them severely. They've recovered, a generation maybe has passed. They've recovered, and now they want to go back to the time as it was during Samson's life when they ruled over the Israelites. And so to me, I'd say most likely, obviously we don't know, but it does look like it is Philistines who are provoking the Israelites.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It definitely could be, right? And I appreciate that. I just, not explicitly told, but that is a good point. Anybody else before we move on? Austin?
It says there 4,000 men, killed about 4,000 men of the army in the field. James E. Smith had a comment that the word there for 1,000 could mean company, or like a company of soldiers or something like that. So it may not be necessarily 1,000. It could be whatever number of company that Israel put forth. So it could be 4,000. It could be maybe a little bit less, a little bit more. But I thought that was an interesting point. The other thing is that, despite all of their idolatry, I really appreciate you bringing out that verse there in chapter 7. They're clearly going against the Lord, and they clearly recognize that the Lord defeated them. I think that's in verse 3. So I think another comment that I heard saw was they thought that the Lord had let them down, had failed them, but they didn't even bother to consider the fact that maybe they had let the Lord down. Mm-hmm. It's just baffling, frankly, their hubris when we see it only in portion.
Yeah, it is pretty silly. This, even though it's a very dark chapter, very serious chapter, it's pretty silly in a lot of ways, at least in my opinion, especially with question 2 when we're talking about them taking the Ark of the Covenant. Any other brother? All right, let's move on to question number 2. And that will be for Trace, I think. Why did Israel think that having the Ark with them would help them win the fight? And why was using the Ark of the Covenant in this way such a disastrous idea?
Okay, so for the first part, part A, they thought it for vain reasons, because they were obviously committing idolatry by putting that much faith not in God, but in the Ark of the Covenant. Because the way it words it is, in verse 3, "Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from Shiloh to us, that when it comes among us, it may save us from the hand of our enemies." That's pretty obvious. I mean, they're way off in left field. So there's that, and then why is this a bad idea? Well, because their thoughts aren't in the right place. Their faith is on the wrong in the wrong place. I mean, they're not thinking about God so much. They're thinking about how they can win this battle and whatever means they see fit. And so there's another place. There's one other example where the Ark of the Covenant is used, Jericho, where they march around Jericho 7 times, the Levites carrying the Ark of the Covenant. And that was a success because that was what God commanded them. God commanded them to march around. And that was a success. And but yeah, here they have not consorted with God. So it's of their own intent.
That's good, brother. Thank you. Yeah, we were talking about precedents that the Israelites have to think that the Ark of the Covenant is the power. Crossing over the Jordan with the Ark of the Covenant and Joshua, as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests who bear the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan. I was supposed to highlight the verse with the Ark of the Covenant. Well, there's verse 11. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is crossing over you. So, I don't know, 100 years maybe since this happened?
300,
okay. 300 years. So, their grandpas are telling about their fathers who, you know, witnessed this. I don't know. And with Trace, too, I'm not going to try and guess the years on that either. But, you know, there's precedent for people thinking the Ark of the Covenant's the magic. But really, it's God telling them to do something with the Ark of the Covenant and then also not being idolaters when he asked them to do that, at least like nationwide. But yeah, I appreciate that. Any other brothers? I thought of 1 Samuel 4:4. You know, it's like the Old Testament, at least in my opinion, doesn't have a lot of emotion into it sometimes. But I like this verse because when you look at it, it really kind of shows you the humor of what's going on here. Let me just reread. So the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark. So I don't know, that just is kind of funny to me because it adds an extra part. It could have just said the Ark of the Covenant, but it says of the Lord of Hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. And then it says, who are the people who are carrying it? The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas. Not the guys you want carrying the Ark of God, especially when, obviously, the Lord didn't command it. Makes you think a lot about the patience of God, that he doesn't just kill all of us. Because he makes this Ark of the Covenant, and these fornicators who fornicate outside of his tabernacle, in the vicinity of his tabernacle, are just getting their hands on the Ark, walking around with it, thinking it's some type of magic power. I don't know. Hey, brother. Bill?
Yeah, I appreciate everything that's been said. I also thought about Jericho. So they had a precedent of using this Ark at different times. Of course, the Lord instructed it. But it seems they're taking this Ark now and using it as a tool without any regard to what God wants to do. They've made up their own mind. They're going to try this. And they're going to bring this in and help have the Ark there would make God fight for them. It's almost like they were trying to make God be their fighter, and it wasn't part of God's plan at all, any of this. And think about this. Think about how messed up Israel would have been had man's ideas here with the Ark actually worked. Think what the future would have looked like with Israel if that would have really worked. It had been all messed up. And the Ark would be worshipped instead of or as much as God. These men, these elders of verse 4, should have been seeking God, getting right with God. And as I love the fact you pointed out, Hophni and Phinehas, two of the probably, very sinful very simple, and here they are leading. Now, we don't know if they were carrying the ark.
I guess that is true.
We know they were accompanying, and they were probably assisting and bossing everybody around. Here's where we need to move it, and that kind of stuff. Again, never consulting the Lord or Samuel, it appears, in any of this. When the ark was used in the past, the Jericho, Israel was told to use the ark. And what could happen? It was captured.
Yep, that's good, brother. Thank you. Yeah. I don't know, I did kind of go back and forth on that. It, you know, it doesn't really matter at all, actually, but so there's no reason for me to talk about it for too long, but that is interesting. I don't know, were they carrying the ark? I mean, I guess they, obviously they were Levites, right? So they have the ability to carry it, but yeah, we just don't know. I think I saw another hand, awesome.
Kind of going off of what Bill said there, it really does seem like they're forcing God's hand, because what does the ark represent? I think it represents God's presence with Israel, right? As that verse said, he is the one who dwells between the cherubim. And of course, the cherubim were crafted out of gold and sat, you know, there on the ark, representing something else, right? So they're trying to force God to take care of them. And I was really considering adding into the questions something about relics, because the Catholic Church is really big on relics, or they used to be at least, and I think they still are today. There's some churches that have a great number of relics where people basically, charlatans back in the Middle Ages, they found, look, these are the bones of Peter. How do you like that? If only you had one, then blessing could come to your house, or something of that nature, of a saint or an apostle or something like that. They would try to find relics in order to give them power. And I think the Lord has never thought that was a good idea. He's always demanded respect. And I think in the chapters we're going to see here later, the things that belong to him deserve respect, but they are not to be worshipped or not to be regarded as holding some kind of power. So I think that's a really good lesson for us to take away from this chapter and throughout the rest of the Bible as well.
Yeah, that's good, brother. That?
Yeah, this talk made me think of that incident in Joshua, where Joshua was near Jericho. People have been talking about Jericho. And remember, there's a man with a sword drawn that Joshua sees, and he says, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" And he says, "No, but as the commander of the Lord's armies, I have come." And so Joshua was a holy man, an observant man, and a pure man, and yet God says to him, doesn't answer that question, you know, instead he says, "No, you know, I am God, and fall down before me," and that's what Joshua does, worships the Lord.
Yeah, no, that's true. I wish somebody like Joshua was here at this time, because it's bad. And Eli's not doing anything about it. But Samuel's pretty awesome, but he's not old enough yet to be, I guess he starts doing stuff in chapter 7, but he's not on the scene quite yet. I think we've got a couple more chapters, actually, with the Ark of the Covenant that is going to be focusing on it, going on journeys and stuff, until chapter 7 where Samuel starts preaching, I guess. I appreciate that. Anybody else? All right, I think we're good to move on to question number 3, which is for Dakota, if you want it. All right. For the first part, how loudly did Israel shout when the ark came into the camp? What do the Philistines know about the Israelites' past? And how did Israel's plan to use the ark to win backfire?
Yeah, so, I mean, it says there, though, so loud that the earth literally shook from the decibels of their voices. Also want to mention kind of the last one that we've already talking. I think it's worthy to mention 2 Samuel chapter 16. That came to mind for me. I'm talking about just the nature of the way they treated the Ark of the Covenant. If you'll recall there, David's trying to get the Ark transported back to Jerusalem, but he does pretty much in a very presumptuous way. They're trying to transport it, and that's the kind of famous chapter where Uzzah reaches out and touches the ark without, and basically in Deuteronomy's, I believe, referenced, and it talks about it was done in an unholy way. So anytime we see presumptuousness with God, it's not a good idea. We see that with Nadab and Abihu as well. So there's a lot of reverence that needs to be approached with God in that case. And then in terms of what do the Philistines know about the Israelites' past? Well, they've obviously heard about the God that sent the plagues on Egypt. They're so very familiar with their stories and the judgment of God coming in that case. It's kind of interesting how they kind of address it. I'd have to look back and see how they particularly said it, but it seems like they allude to a concept of, yeah, these mighty gods. So apparently they were under the delusion that there was a polytheistic kind of God structure that the Israelites followed, not understanding that it is the one true God. And then how did Israel's plan to use the earth to win backfire? Well, they really didn't have God's blessing in doing that in the first place, as I alluded to. So they couldn't expect that to, basically God to operate on their behalf in that way. So we see that they were utterly devastated by the force that the Philistines had. And something that's important to understand about the Philistines is they had technology that the Israelites didn't have at this time. They had the benefit of Greek technology and the use of iron that really historically is believed the Israelites did not have. So when it came to a fight, they were kind of bringing a knife to a gunfight, so to speak. So if they didn't have God on their side, and they're not living in a faithful way to have his support, then this would be the reasonable expectation, numbers-wise and technology-wise.
That's good, brother. Thank you. I had this. So I was talking to Dad about this on Monday, and we were talking about the Israelites shouting, and he was like, "That's kind of like sports." And I was like, "I mean, I guess, but I don't really know how to tie that in." But then I happened to be talking to Austin on Tuesday, I think it was, and he also mentioned sports. But it was a little bit more specific. He told me there was a football game where it was college football in 1988, and people were so hyped up, and they shouted so loud and stomped their feet so loud that it actually got registered on like a seismograph. And was technically an earthquake, I think, is what people say about it. So, yeah, it's possible. It's not. It sounds like it's almost miraculous when you read it in this chapter. Obviously, it wasn't. Israelites were messed up, and they're so hyped about the Ark of the Covenant that they are hyped about it. They think it's going to win the battle, so they're yelling super loud, and maybe they caused a small earthquake. I don't know. Any brother? Any comment? Bill?
I want to hop on that sports bandwagon just a minute. I know it's hard to imagine. I was at the Missouri-Oklahoma game when Missouri ran the opening kickoff back 100 for a touchdown to start the game, first play of the game on kickoff. A guy I work with, been going to games for 30 years, him and his wife, he said that was the loudest he'd ever heard it. I think me and the boys were at this game. I'm not for sure, but I was at it. And that would have been 60, 70,000. Listen to these numbers. So that would have been 60, 65,000, maybe 70,000. It was probably a sellout with Oklahoma. And I think Oklahoma was ranked really high. So that was people screaming and shouting then. My buddy said it was the loudest he'd ever heard it. But the ground wasn't shaking that I know of. So here's 30,000 Israelites were killed in this second battle. You got the 4,000, now you got 30,000 are gonna be killed. And if it was a slaughter, let's say there was 60,000 total, that was 60,000 at the Mizzou game I'm talking about. And so to your point, and I think you're exactly right, these guys were jacked up. They were more excited than the fans at the football game because the Ark of the Covenant's here and now we're gonna win. So I think that's really neat to try to appreciate that.
Yeah, they must have, I don't know, must have been problem solving.
What do we do?
And, some guy gives some really good speech about how the Ark of the Covenant's going to, like, they're going to get revenge on the Philistines, and they get super excited. So, yeah, I appreciate that.
Oh, I had one other. They shouted loud enough for the ground to shake, but they didn't shout loud enough for the Lord to hear.
Hmm. That's interesting, brother. I had this verse. This is what Dakota was talking about just a second ago. He pointed out how it's hypocritical of the Israelites, because even the Philistines say gods with the plural. So Israelites are not doing their job manifesting God to the surrounding nations, because even the surrounding nations say gods, because they don't know it was the Lord who they had one God. So that was interesting. Any other brother? Any comments? Okay, question number 4 for Uncle Malin. What is the significance of torn clothes and dirt on the head? How was Eli described? How did Eli die? What are some of the positive and negative things we can learn from what was written about Eli?
Yeah, so for the first part, from what I was reading, it sounded like whenever you had bad news or evil news, like a messenger, whenever they were bringing that kind of news, they would tear their clothes and put dirt on their head. So that was kind of a sign of bad news to come. And then, so the second part is, well, we're told that Eli was 98 years old, so pretty old there. He was a heavy man, and he couldn't see very well. His eyesight wasn't very good. Part C, how did he die? From what we read, he fell backwards in his seat at the gate and fell off and broke his neck. And that's after he heard about the ark going to the Philistines and being lost there. So the last part here, positives and negatives. I just have a few of each. So pros, I mean, he was a judge, a priest, probably a good man, except for having, I guess, evil sons. And so that kind of leads into the con part, that evil sons. Of course, he was a larger man, so perhaps he liked to indulge in food and stuff like that. And then he failed to teach his family about the Lord. That's kind of what led into his children.
That's good, brother. Thank you. Yeah, I agree with what you said. That's something about that. How is Eli described? I don't know. I wanted to have like a mental image of Eli. So I Googled some paintings and stuff, but I could not find a single painting or any image where he wasn't, like all of them, he was skinny. I don't know what's going on. I don't get how you paint a character that is told that he's told he's fat like twice. Not only was he skinny, he was also like some European Roman looking guy. So I don't know. No images on Eli. Any brother have any comments? Logan?
Yeah, just as far as negative things you can say about him, I'm not sure it's been mentioned yet, but you know, I think he mirrors like the modern milquetoast Christian in a lot of ways, right? Where maybe you're raised in the church and you've got these duties and, you know, oh, it's laid out for me. I'll just do it. But, you know, we talk about it all the time. Maybe not all the time, but we warn ourselves pretty often, you know, that churches in Revelation do the first works, you know. You're doing all these things, you're testing the doctrine, but your heart's not in it. And maybe that was his situation for his whole life. You know, he's assuming this role of priest, but he's not willing to take responsibility for his sons when they divert from the path. You know, so he's like, oh, it's just kind of gone this way. God will do what God's going to do. So maybe some parallels we can take away from that.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, it's interesting looking at his apathy, because he's not almost completely apathetic, because he at one point he's like, hey guys, stop it. But that doesn't really do anything about it. So yeah, I do think there's a comparison there. I appreciate that. I had let me see here. So there's, let me try and remember what I was gonna say on this slide. Oh yeah. I don't know, this goes back to, if you know, feel free to interrupt me at any point if you have something useful to say. But because I'm not sure how important this is, but I'm thinking about how Eli died. So it says in the verse, I actually don't have the verse on there, but he's like super anxious because he's waiting for news. He's sitting by the gate, it says, and he's waiting for somebody to come back. And I think the verse says, I wish I had it here, but it says something about him, his heart. Oh, wait. Yeah, no, I have it there. Where his heart trembled for the ark of God. And so, I don't know, he's not actually sitting on the gate. He's just sitting on like some kind of chair by the gate. And I don't know, I was thinking about it, and this really doesn't matter, but I was like, if he is sitting on some sort of chair outside the gate, how did he break his neck? Because obviously the type of chair he's sitting on doesn't have like a back on it. So, because he fell straight backwards. So, I mean, how do you fall backwards and specifically crack your neck? I was talking to Bill. I was talking to Dad, and he said if you're very large and you fall over, like just the force of your back, well, and keep in mind he was like 90 something, your back is going to like, the force of hitting the ground with your back will like snap your neck physically. So you don't actually have to land on your neck, but the force of that has the ability to snap your neck. So I was thinking about it. I was like, he could have had a heart attack because he's sitting there like super freaking out about the ark. And he knows he has a bad feeling in the stomach, and the anxiety is just building up. And when finally the guy gets there and tells him, I don't know, he could have had a heart attack or he could have fainted. I've never been so blown away by something that I just physically fall over. But of course I've never had anything like this happen. But still though, it's not a jump scare. If you get jump scared, you'll jump. But if you just get told information, you're not just gonna blow back unless you get a heart attack. At least that's what I think of. Because he's old and he's fat. So likelihood of a heart attack is up there. Oh yeah. This was a pretty cool photo. I think we talked about the Shiloh excavations last week, but they're excavating a place they're pretty confident is Shiloh, and these are the same image, but highlighted in red is what they think was the front gate. So they I don't know, it's archaeology stuff, but they did something with the gaps or something to where they're pretty sure this is the northern gate. So this, you could be looking at the place where Eli fell off and broke his neck and died, but we don't know. Well,
so you mentioned trying to visualize it, and I like that because I try to do that a lot myself. And we know that the leaders of cities, the rulers, would sit at the gates. We've noticed that in times past. I see Eli, a big old boy, and I see him on a stand, an elevated platform with a chair on it. And maybe the elevated platform would get these leaders of the town as they hung around the gates. They could observe what was going in and out. And being a little bit elevated would have helped that. I don't know if the chair had a back on it or not. It probably did, thinking about an old man sitting in a chair. Mm. It probably did have a back. But if it went over the back, you could see how that would happen.
So you're saying that it was a bit of a back, but it wasn't too big to where he couldn't fall over it.
No, I think it was a platform with a chair on it, and maybe two or three chairs where the leaders of the city could sit.
Okay.
And then he could fall off from 2 or 3 feet up in the air and for sure hit his neck.
Okay.
Just a thought.
Yeah. Yeah, my dad pointed out, I was talking to him about this, it couldn't have been anything up too high because he's old and he's big, so he wouldn't climb too. He couldn't have been sitting on the gate. So that's interesting.
Someone would have helped him up a couple steps, and he's going to sit there most of the day.
That's true.
And I was reading, and a guy said, we don't know if he died of a broken heart first or a broken neck.
Yeah.
Kind of like what you said.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good. I believe it's 8:30, so we don't got too much longer on this question. Anybody have any quick comments? Awesome.
I have one quick comment. This is... We need to have some appreciation for the Benjamite, because this dude booked it 20 miles in one day, relatively speaking, from where the battle was over to Shiloh. So you want to talk about some dedicated running after all this. So a little appreciation for the Benjamite. But also, The way it kind of ends there with Eli, for almost all the judges, it talks about how they died and they were buried in this place, and it may talk about like some of their accomplishments or something like that. Instead, with Eli, it is the darkest day up to this point, pretty much, in Israel's history as a nation. And he dies in one of the most humiliating ways possible. So the Bible really paints this dark, kind of disappointing, not very flattering light of Eli at all. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah, no, I was thinking about that too. I don't think the Bible would have any character die like that, where you know you're supposed to look on him in a good way. But yep, that's good, brother. I'm gonna move on to the last question, which is for Logan. Okay. What happened to Phinehas' wife upon hearing all the terrible news? What does the name Ichabod mean? Why did she name her child this name? And what could this tell us about her character?
All right. I'll try and get this hammered out here. So what happened to her? She gave birth, obviously, to a child. And then she died, right? Let's see exactly in the verse here. Do not fear, for you have borne a son. About the time of her death. So she's dying here. And this woman that's tending to her is trying to distract her, maybe comfort her a little bit and say, you have borne a son. And she did not answer nor regard it. And so this child is named Ichabod. What does that mean? Right here in the bottom margin of this Bible, it says inglorious. I've seen a couple different renditions of this. They're all pretty much the same thing. Without glory, where has the glory gone? Basically that kind of thing. And why did she name her child this? Well, pretty self-explanatory, right? We've been discussing the inglory of all of these events, right? It's just a name to put maybe a capstone on this chapter, kind of tie everything together, all these terrible, terrible events. As for what this says about her character, I don't know. We've been going back and forth on Eli, right? Like, we're scratching our heads about it. We don't know what to think about him totally. You know, we've got bad things and a couple good things. But you could say, you know, I think the most you could say is that she's very, very, she's grieving a lot. Her husband and her father-in-law, right? They're all dead. Such a terrible loss in the battle. And so, you know, she's without hope, and she's dying just like Eli is dying without hope. And I don't want to make any comments on how faithful of a woman she was. I mean, I guess you could assume some negative things, but I won't get into that.
Yeah. Yep, that's good. Yeah, I completely agree with the importance of Ichabod. I think it's kind of an interesting thing the Holy Spirit did, including this part in where, you know, at the end of this narrative here, we're going to have a lady bear a child and name him Ichabod. But, you know, it's interesting that the Bible repeats it twice. The glory has departed, and then it says again, the glory has departed. So it's kind of just emphasizing this is not good. And I agree with you on the character. I don't really think we can determine anything about it. I think it's different than Eli. Eli died in a way that was really humiliating, but it could have just been like women die while giving birth all the time, so it could have just been natural. Although the Holy Spirit could have made this happen, I don't know. We don't really know the nature of this woman. Although I do have to say it would be interesting being married to Phinehas. What an awful dude. Sleeping around the tabernacle. And so she's just depressed, obviously. She has this baby. She learns her husband is dead, which, I don't know. That in itself might have not been the worst thing ever, her husband dying. If, you know, Phinehas is not a good dude, but whatever. Just getting into the thick of it. Dakota?
Yeah, I would just like to maybe advocate on her behalf a little bit. You know, she has all this carnal loss in her life, where she's lost a spouse. Even if he's a terrible person, she's probably very bonded to that person. But yeah, she does seem to focus on the glory of God as life causes to be part of, you know, Arthas departed. So I think it's possible, we can't obviously say a lot either way, but it's also possible that she really did care about that, because that's what was foremost on her mind. Most women in birth and having a new baby, they're just going to be all, you know, very focused on the baby, but she's very, it seems at least spiritually minded in that scene there. So I think maybe we could advocate, maybe she was actually pretty spiritual in her own right. She was just kind of in a bad situation with a terrible man and a terrible legacy and that kind of thing. And I want to touch a little bit on Eli too. Obviously a very checkered past. I don't know if you guys talked about this last week in the previous chapter in verse 18. I found it very kind of bizarre, his response and kind of that apathy that people have been alluding to. Back in 18 he says, and he said, "It is the Lord, let him do what seems good to him." Mm-hmm. Kind of response to Samuel telling him about the vision that he has about the things that are going to come upon him. So obviously she's surrounded by a lot of this apathetic attitude, a very terrible son going on his act. So I think that's possible.
That's good, brother. Logan, did you raise your hand?
Yeah, I did for a second. I appreciate what Dakota said about her, you know, maybe having some faith here. I just briefly thought about Job's wife, right? All this these terrible things happen. She says, curse God and die. And that's not what she's doing here. She's not saying that exactly. She's just saying the glory is left. So yeah. I appreciate it.
That's good. I appreciate that. Yeah, just wrapping up here. Yes, Bill?
I found a quote that I thought would be nice to share.
Okay.
In the late 1970s, a five-line inscription was found on a grain silo in the ruins of Isbeth Shartah. When deciphered, it was found to contain a Philistine account of this battle, the capture of the ark, even specifically mentioning the priest Tophnim. This is the earliest known extra-biblical reference to an Old Testament event. So I thought that was kind of neat to consider that. And I realized tonight that we don't know anything about Eli until we get to 1 Samuel chapter 1. You know, and now he's done. He's not around very long. And one last point. I think, I agree with Dakota, I think there's some potential that this woman might have been the most righteous of all of these characters that we've seen right here. We don't know, but we can speculate. Passages like Psalm 78, Jeremiah 7:12, and Jeremiah 26:9 all read that Shiloh was destroyed by the Philistines after this. Mm. So I think those people knew what was coming.
Yeah, that's good, brother. I know we're probably getting antsy here, but I just wanted to play off that just a little bit because, really quickly though, I don't know, I'm not sure if I completely agree with it being spiritual to Ichabod, because Eli was very concerned about the Ark of God. It's the point where he died because he heard the Ark of the God was stolen, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's a good person. I mean, it does mean that he's concerned about spiritual things, but again, you can't say anything negative about the mother of Ichabod. I don't know. Obviously, it's not the most anything to get dogmatic over, but any closing comments from any brethren? All right, well, that wraps up our study for tonight. I thank you guys so much for participating in the study.